Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Your independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, reminding you that you too can support this amazing community resource by going to the website at kboo.fm and clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner. On today's show, we hear about present and future pandemics, about cutting the bloated military budget to invest in human well-being, and about a novel embracing race, class, and gender. Variety is our middle name. As for the rest of our name, the Old Mole was a term that Karl Marx used to describe the revolution, working underground for long before bursting forth. Eruptions of rebellion may seem to spring up suddenly, that is, but really come from less visible long-term work. If it seems that there are decades where nothing happens, it may just be happening underground. And if this past weekend was one in which decades happened, well, I can't comment on that, since because of the pandemic, our shows are pre-recorded, and I'm speaking to you from the past. But the long-term struggles for global health and social needs, for peace and racial justice, these continue. First up on today's show, Bill Resnick talks with microbiologist Dr. Michael Friedman about COVID-19, what we know about it, the mistakes made globally, nationally, and locally in efforts to stem transmission, and what we would need to do to keep us all healthy. They also talked back in April this year about the ways that environmental destruction is leading to increasing spread of new diseases. We'll link to those episodes when we post this show on the KBOO website. Then we hear Patricia Kullberg read a review from book mole Larry Bolden of the newly released and already best-selling novel from Britt Bennett, The Vanishing Half, about twin sisters in the second half of the 20th century, one who returns to the black community where they grew up, the other who keeps her past a secret from her white husband. Finally, Laurie Mercier interviews Ashiq Siddiq, a research analyst for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, working on the federal budget and military spending and examining how militarized U.S. domestic and foreign policy threatens efforts to address crises like accelerating inequality and climate change. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Those audio posts generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't plan to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also find on our KBOO page the link to subscribe to our show on your podcast listening service, and links to friend or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour, all one lowercase word, @gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or suggestions. We'd love to hear from you. We turn now to Bill Resnick talking with Mike Friedman.
Hi, Mike Friedman. Welcome to KBOO for a continuation of our discussion of the COVID pandemic.
Hi, Bill. Thank you, and it's nice to talk to you again.
Mike Friedman is an evolutionary biologist, studies the microbiome, teaches and writes in biology department in the University of Antigua and Barbuda. For the last year, and especially since the development of the COVID-19 virus, he's been following it very carefully. COVID-19, of course, is a respiratory disease. It's been detected in over 4 million people now in the United States, killed close to 150,000. Mike, a lot has happened in the last 7 months since the first cases were discovered in China. We know considerably more about the virus, though to be sure many important things remain in doubt. Today we'll draw on what we know, how to successfully deal with it, and protect human life, and also maintain sufficient production of necessary goods to live a good life. Now, to be sure, Trump and his administration have botched it completely up to now, now running wild across the United States. Still, even today, things could be done. It would be an enormous task. Second, today we'll talk about what's needed to prepare for what seems a certainty that at some point the virus gets transmitted from animals to humans, that is both highly contagious, much more than COVID-19, and also highly lethal. COVID-19 is dangerous. Some viruses have proven to be highly lethal. No virus recently in the last several hundred years has proved to be both highly lethal and highly contagious, but it surely could come. In fact, it's very likely to come if we continue the way we're operating today in terms of the economic development and the penetration of every ecosystem on Earth to make it profitable for human beings. Mike, tell us about that Herculean effort, but what would be necessary to stop COVID-19 in this country? What are the lessons we've learned?
Well, the main lesson is that you have to start early, and you have to conduct adequate testing from early on in order to be able to survey community transmission and to be able to trace contacts and then quarantine people. And you also have to implement adequate social distancing, personal protection, and stay-in-place or lockdown-type situations. But all of this needs to be done early before cases spread out and transmission is widespread. And, of course, this is complicated by the fact that there is transmission of coronavirus from asymptomatic cases. That's the big thing that I think we've learned. The other thing that we've learned from all of these cities that are reopening and countries that didn't take the appropriate measures, like Sweden, is that you can't reopen precipitously. You can't reopen without adequate controls in place. Even California, I was going to say Florida, in which basically the state government ignored precautions and basically followed the line of Donald Trump. But even in California, you had a situation where opening was precipitous. Because of the national mixed messaging, a lot of people did not abide by proper social distancing and protection, you know, masks. And now California, of course, is increasing. In this country, almost 99% of the decisions that are made regarding public health are going to be made with at least an eye to corporations and making money and profits. Those are going to be in the back of policymakers' minds or in the front of their minds. That meant that a lot of places in the U.S. threw caution to the wind, and then they just reopened their economies. And so in some cases, they never shut down, like, for example, meatpacking plants.
So it's gotten out of control in the U.S., nearly everywhere, but it is not running wild now, apparently, in New York City.
Not yet.
Running wild again, because
right.
It is opening up. In New York, there was a day, apparently, very recently, where there were no deaths in New York versus the thousands of deaths not 2 months ago per day. That indicates a lockdown really can be effective as long as it's continued and as long as you don't have people migrating into the city from places where COVID is running wild and where you're getting a lot of asymptomatic people coming in and infecting those New Yorkers.
Yeah, but there's no wall around New York.
Yeah, that's a big problem in the United States. People move a lot. We're number one in the world in the use of energy per capita, and a lot of it is gasoline and moving around. Go deeper into the problems of what isolation and lockdown would mean.
Okay. Two of the big problems are first the size of the country and its diversity, its demographic diversity and its geographic diversity and its urban-rural diversity. Because of the size of the country, that immediately creates a problem with trying to maintain any kind of tracing and testing and isolation and so on. And then the second problem, as you mentioned, is the socioeconomic disparities in the U.S., which put limits on people's ability to respond to the stay-at-home orders, for example, or to obtain testing. Basically, if you impose shelter in place on a population that doesn't have decent access to supermarkets or doesn't have decent access to housing or is jailed or any number of similar conditions.
Doesn't have income to order in food from your local restaurant.
Can't use Seamless or Grubhub or those, right? Yeah, these are two of the major difficulties in organizing a response in this country, which are historic and structural or physical. So taking that into account, you would have to have a coordinated response. That's number one. You need coordination from the federal down through the states. Number two, you would have to have in place the social support network that would allow you to support people who are in lockdown in, you know, Native American reservations or in impoverished communities in the cities. You would also have to have adequate legislation in place so that essential workers are protected and they have sick leave and they have sick pay and so on and so forth. Then you would also have to have in place something which was basically decimated by years of neoliberal cutbacks, an adequate public health system. I think the figure is 56,000 public health workers were laid off in the past decade or so. This public health network is essential for surveillance, for screening, for getting out PPE. We saw some of what public health does during the HIV period, where people would do testing and they would work in health education, for example, in the gay community. So these are some of the things that need to be in place. With those in place, you can carry out the type of testing you need to survey communities, look for hotspots, trace contacts, monitor people coming into the country or moving around. And that has a bad ring to it given our context, but those are the types of things that are needed. With those measures in place, you could implement selective containment measures. So in some cases, people can go out if adequate measures are taken. So a lockdown doesn't necessarily have to be 100%, although if we're going to do it right, it might require a reset where we are implementing a full lockdown. And then as people study how the disease is transmitted in certain areas and certain populations, you can begin to ease up.
Mike, one thing that's favorable, it seems to me, in being able to maintain a lockdown for a while and get people essential services and get food to people, and it would have to be to everybody, is that COVID-19 is contagious primarily, in my understanding, through aerosols or through droplets in the air.
As you said, coronavirus is transmitted through droplets and aerosols. It's a respiratory infection. In this, it differs from a number of other diseases that we've seen epidemics in recent years, like Ebola, which is body fluids, or norovirus, which is foods, and so on. A respiratory tract disease is more highly transmissible than these other forms. One of the problems we've had is that until recently, the WHO refused to concede that it was transmitted by aerosol. They thought it was just transmitted by larger droplets. So the larger droplets mean that they would fall from the air quickly and maybe your social distancing of 6 feet was an adequate response. And by the way, that six-foot rule is kind of antiquated. This came from the 40s or earlier. But when you have aerosol transmission, the virus can spread out much further than 6 feet. transmission have implications for the types of measures you would take, so that you would want, for example, adequate ventilation in facilities where you're going to have people moving around or congregating, like factories, that the six-foot rule is kind of a vague and maybe not so great rule of thumb. Social distancing means being prudent.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mike Friedman, a microbiologist, especially since the outbreak of COVID. He's been studying viruses and virus transmission and the way, in fact, viruses can be dealt with. We've been discussing that in terms of what could be done now in the United States. Even now, it would be a huge effort, a huge project, requiring maybe more cooperation and public acceptance than can be gained in this country. Do you think it's conceivable we have to, in fact, stop the pursuit of profits for 2 months, maybe not 1 month, which is what New York succeeded in, a month and a half, although they have a lot of in-migration into New York? Would that be possible? Or do you think that the forces of profit overall would prevail in the Democratic Party?
I don't place much hope in a Democratic administration taking the type of deep-rooted measures that would have to be taken to fully deal with this pandemic. They have the capability to do it, as we saw earlier this year. But all the while, you have these corporations champing at the bit to put the economy back into motion. And so these corporations, this is not a question of choice, it's a question of necessity, because the usual dynamic is always going to be in place, where if you're not making profits, if you're not able to compete with your corporations and you're not raking in profits, then you risk going out of business. Plus the fact that the Democratic Party is committed to the same neoliberal policies they were before. I mean, there are social modifications. So yes, I think a Biden administration might take some palliative measures, but is it going to be willing to shut down when it needs to shut down? Is it going to be willing to legislate for unions, for workers to have full paid benefits, full paid leave? Is it going to be willing to legislate for single payer, which basically Biden has rejected? So I don't think it's capable of taking the types of measures that need to be taken. But there's always the caveat that if working people can get together, and if the unions can become belligerent and aggressive in making demands around these things, then they'll win concessions. The bottom line here, as with climate change or anything else, is class struggle can make a difference. In the case of a pandemic like this, it can make a big difference, because if you can force the government to take some of these actions, then you can contain the virus until the RO drops low enough and basically it, for all intents and purposes, vanishes like it did in a small country like New Zealand. I mean, there are all kinds of ifs involved here. A lot of the politicians seem to think that they can hang on until this becomes a new normal, a miserable normal for most people, or they can hang on until we develop herd immunity. These are all wrinkles which can affect the outcome.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Mike Friedman, a microbiologist who's been studying COVID-19 and other viruses and studying the research. Mike, COVID-19 is a virus that's highly contagious, and it's very dangerous, but it's not close to 100% lethal like some viruses where the contagion could be contained. It's more contagious, you've discussed, than the flu, and it's more dangerous than the flu. It seems a certainty to me, though, and I think to microbiologists, that the mother of all viruses, a virus is bound to, at some time in the future, be transmitted from animals to humans, that is both highly contagious in many ways, touching, aerosols, every other way that it could be contagious. And will be passed from human to human. It's very contagious and very lethal, like Ebola, for example. There's no genetic reason that those mutations in time would not develop. So what would be necessary in terms of building a public health system, or is it even possible? What kind of public health system do we need that could make a response to that virus of all viruses?
Ed Young wrote an article in The Atlantic earlier this month called America Should Prepare for a Double Pandemic. According to Young, there are about 40,000 known viruses in other mammals, about a quarter of which could be transmitted to human beings. So that's a lot of viruses we can obtain from livestock, from animals we increasingly come into contact with in the wild as we reduce their habitats. People have been predicting this for years, that there was going to be a pandemic, because there has been surveillance. People know that there are constantly cases of transmission on pig farms, for example, different types of virus, a lot of different types of flu. Fortunately for us, they haven't mutated to the degree where they can be transmitted between people. So they'll be transmitted from pigs, you'll get sick, and then you recover from it or not. We talked about the measures that would have to be taken to forestall these pandemics the last time we spoke. What kind of broad international and national response would we need, and what kind of institutions would we have to have in place? Well, for one thing, on a broad scale, you would have to have functional institutions at an international level that are coordinating public health efforts. We have the WHO right now, which has shown its own limitations and is also being panned by Donald Trump. That has the potential effect of preventing the WHO from working adequately, but it also creates doubt in terms of the WHO. So if the U.S. withdraws, other countries, allies are withdrawn, basically the thing falls apart. So you need international institutions that can coordinate surveillance. You need international institutions that have some bite, that can deal with international trade, international legality, immigration, and so on, tourism, and so on and so forth. And I'm not advocating, by the way, for banning tourism or banning immigration, but I'm saying that we need institutions that can monitor and account for these. At a national level, we need basically the same things I outlined before. You need an adequate public health system. You need to invest in clinical medicine as well, because we saw what's been happening. Doctors are probably at the point of breakdown right now. Doctors, nurses, other health workers are burning out. If we get hit with another pandemic at this point, that will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Hospital, bed space, equipment have all been diverted into the COVID-19 crisis. And if there's another pandemic, it's going to pile on top of that. Plus, if it's another, as is likely, respiratory pandemic, the effects will be partially masked by similar symptoms in coronavirus patients.
You know, one final thing, Mike. What you would need is a vast amount of public cooperation. You would need a public that was not suspicious of anything that government does, who recognizes we're all in this together, who are ready to make sacrifices for other people and understand that, who are ready to cooperate in great national endeavors, even if they're at the expense of themselves, who are ready, in fact, to pay taxes because they know they're necessary. It seems to me the U.S. and U.S. capitalism, the fish rots from the top. We really have to return to a sense of community and cooperation and social justice for everybody, people of color, of course, and the white working class. It seems to me we really have to create a different country very quickly that really is characterized by that cooperation and willing to sacrifice, or at least this country could be finished.
Yeah, I mean, we have to break with the Thatcher-Reaganite idea that there is no such thing as society. And basically that means that we have to overturn 40-plus years of neoliberal policies and the ethos that accompanied those policies. Everything that's done here atomizes people into individuals that have no real connection to each other. The only connection that's forged is the one that comes from below, and that's, we've seen that happening. But we have to overturn that type of mentality. As you say, the fish rots from the top, so what we also have to do is have a system in which there is coherent and human need-guided policymaking from the top down through all of the different levels of society.
Yeah, well, it also has to bubble up from the anarchist position when they say we are all leaders. People have to have the sense that they are treating justly, they are not just listened to, but are part of the decisional process and are prepared to, in fact, think about those things and not, you know, entertain themselves rather than actually being social participants. Mike Friedman, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Mike.
Fever in the morning, a fever all through the night. Everybody's got the fever, that is something you all know. Fever isn't such a new thing, fever started long ago.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. And before Peggy Lee singing about her fever, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Dr. Michael Friedman, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Antigua and Barbuda. When this segment is posted on the KBOO website, you'll be able to find links also to their earlier conversation on the roots of pandemics in environmental destruction, as well as to this one on the need for public health measures not driven by profit. Later on today's show, we'll come back to the problems of monetary interests when Laurie Mercier talks with Ashiq Sadiq of the National Priorities Project about profiteering weapons manufacturers and the continuing efforts to cut the military budget and realize a people's vision of a more peaceful, more equal, and more sustainable world. But now, we turn to a different kind of imaginative work and hear Patricia Kullberg reading Bookmole Larry Bolden's review of Britt Bennett's recently released novel, The Vanishing Half.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg reading today a book review for our Bookmole Larry Bolden. I want to talk to you today about a 2020 novel by Britt Bennett entitled The Vanishing Half. It is the story of twin girls who run away from a small town when they are 16, and only one of them returns 14 years later. The vanishing half, Stella, is missed and searched for by Desiree, the twin who returned. The small town from which they run is named Mallard. Quote, "It was a strange town, Mallard, named after the ringneck ducks living in the rice fields and marshes. A town that, like any other, was more idea than place. The idea arrived to Alphonse de Quier in 1848 as he stood in the sugarcane fields he's inherited from the father who'd once owned him. The father now dead, the now freed son, wished to build something on those acres of land that would last for centuries to come. A town for men like him, who would never be accepted as white, but refused to be treated like Negroes. His mother, rest her soul, had hated his lightness. When he was a boy, she'd shoved him under the sun, begging him to darken. Maybe that's what made him dream of the town. Lightness, like anything inherited at great cost, was a lonely gift. He'd married a mulatto, even lighter than himself. She was pregnant then with their first child, and he imagined his children's children's children, lighter still, like a cup of coffee steadily diluted with cream, a more perfect Negro, each generation lighter than the one before." End quote. Like Alice Walker's In Search of Our Mother's Garden and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, Bennett takes on questions of race, gender, and identity. It is Desiree who is the restless one and feels compelled to escape the small town. But since the twins are inseparable, Stella agrees to leave with her, and it is Stella who does not return. Their mother and other town folk are sure they will both return soon. Quote, "They'd run out of money and gall and come sniffling back to their mother's porch. But they never returned again. Instead, after a year, the twins scattered, their lives splitting evenly as their shared egg. Stella became white, and Desiree married the darkest man she could find." End quote. Although Stella is bright and has many skills, when she applies for office jobs and honestly identifies herself as Negro, she is turned away. But when she allows employers to see her as white, she is hired. Quote, "At work, Stella became Miss Vigna, or as Desiree called her, White Stella." Bennett spends a lot of time describing the many shades of color of Negroes, from clabber white to blue-black. Ironically, Stella doesn't really decide to pass for white. She simply lets others see her as they choose. Quote, "But what had changed about her? Nothing, really. She hadn't adopted a disguise or even a new name. She's walked in a colored girl and left a white one. She had become white only because everyone thought she was." End quote. But then Stella begins to date a man from her office, and eventually they marry. Of course, she cannot let her husband find out. Now she must disappear completely into her new white life. She has a daughter, and it is the daughter who eventually discovers Stella's secret and despises her for it. Because of a photograph of the twin sisters that Stella's daughter discovers, Stella is finally forced to acknowledge her true history. In order to find her estranged daughter, Kennedy, she returns to her hometown and to Desiree. Quote, "Like leaving, the hardest part of returning was deciding to." End quote. I have focused primarily on questions of color and race, but this is also the story of a family from the 1950s to the 1990s and all the political turmoil of those times, the assassinations of the Kennedys and of Martin Luther King. Author Bennett mainly simply observes and describes, but the descriptions make clear where her allegiances are. I think this is a wonderful, important, and insightful novel. It sent me scurrying back to Morrison's The Bluest Eye. I hope I have not given away too much of the plot, since this is partly a kind of mystery story along with its social commentary. I intend to go back to Bennett's earlier novel, The Mothers. She writes with great heart and wisdom. I've been talking about Brett Bennett's novel, The Vanishing Half. This is Patricia Kullberg reading for Larry Bolden and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was, of course, a little bit of Louis Armstrong, and before that, our Book Mole review of The Vanishing Half, a novel by Britt Bennett. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, your host for this July 27th, 2020 episode. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m., rain or shine, heat wave or pandemic, with views, reviews, and interviews from perspectives emphasizing grassroots, collective, and radically democratic solutions to the economic, environmental, and socio-political problems we face. Next up, Laurie Mercier talks with Ashiq Sadiq, one of the co-authors of the Poor People's Campaign's Moral Budget and a founding member of the Climate Mobilization. He's now a researcher with the National Priorities Project, and he and Laurie discuss some causes and consequences of the nation's bloated military budget, as well as the hopeful prospects for changing the nation's budget priorities.
Hello, everyone. I'm speaking with Ashiq Sadiq, who is a research analyst for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, working on the federal budget and military spending, and examining how militarized U.S. domestic and foreign policy threatens efforts to address crises like accelerating inequality and climate change. He publishes widely, including lots of excellent reports posted on the National Priorities Project site, and is one of the co-authors of the Poor People's Campaign Moral Budget. Prior to joining the National Priorities Project, Ashiq Sadiq was the research lead and founding member of the Climate Mobilization. Welcome to KBOO, Ashiq.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the House and Senate vote this week that approved the massive $740 billion Pentagon military budget. Now, Bernie Sanders and Barbara Lee introduced bills in the House and Senate to cut the bloated budget by a very modest 10%, with the money saved slotted to underwrite human and social programs in cities and communities. Now, one would hope that in this moment of cities reexamining their funding of local police departments, that the nation would consider or reconsider the astronomical amount devoted to its global policing of Black and brown people. But it looks like the proposal did not appear to receive any serious attention. Or did it? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's worth putting this in context of the Pentagon budget just being steadily increased for years with bipartisan support and very few members dissenting. Usually every time this is up for a vote, there might be a few progressives, maybe some libertarians on the Republican side who object, but there's really not much organized opposition, or there hasn't been for the past, like, really two decades. So this year is a meaningful shift in that it came to a vote at all. I think the last time any kind of cut was on the table was 3 or 4 years ago, and the amount proposed to cut was much smaller, and it got way less votes than it did this time. I think something on the order of 70 votes in the House, and it didn't go any further than that. So to get a vote to cut 10% of it, as modest as you said as it is, which it really is a modest cut compared to a $740 billion budget, it's kind of a big deal that it came to a vote in both houses at once, and that it got even as much support as it did, as much as, you know, we're obviously disappointed that it failed. But to get almost 100 votes in the House and a quarter of the Senate is a higher benchmark than we had before, which, you know, it's sad that the bar is so low, because this really just is such a sensible thing. Even before COVID, to redirect this amount of money would have been very sensible. And now, in the middle of the biggest economic crisis of our lifetime, you would think this is common sense. So it really shows the disparity between where people in Congress are versus where the American people are, which is, you know, very supportive of something like this, as has been polled.
Yes, and that's why it seems like it's so important what the National Priorities Project is doing in terms of highlighting the trade-offs, because $740 billion just seems so abstract. People can't wrap their heads around it or have no idea about what the federal budget looks like. And really, this 10% cut was only taking the Pentagon's budget back to the Obama years. So it certainly was high to begin with, and it has been increasing, you know, in the 21st century. But tell us about this work of the National Priorities Project to try to provide people concrete ideas about what those trade-offs mean. So with a 10% cut, tell us about the significance of that and what it represents within that larger budget.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give people a picture of what the military budget itself is, people have a very abstract idea of, you know, what that amount of such an enormous amount of money even does. So usually the excuse given to keep raising it is that we want to support the troops, right? But only about a fifth of that budget goes to directly supporting the troops in terms of pay and benefits. Over half of it goes to military contractors, all these big private companies that sell weapons like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, and they're giving the biggest share of their profits to CEOs who just are directly profiting from war, compared to the lowest ranked soldier who gets $20,000. In 2018, the CEO of Lockheed Martin took home $20 million. So just a huge chunk of this budget is going to contractors who just directly benefit from escalating wars all over the place, which make the entire world less safe, including Americans. So to cut 10% of it, which would be $74 billion this year, is a really small amount to the military, because there have been studies about how much waste there is in the military budget. One internal study found over $125 billion in administrative waste alone, just because there are all these contracts that aren't properly accounted for. They've failed multiple audits in recent years. So just from a fiscal conservative viewpoint, the Pentagon is doing a terrible job at just keeping track of where this money's even going. But if you compare that to any kind of social priorities that are already severely underfunded by the federal government, it's just really illuminating and kind of depressing just to see how much money that could do. So $74 billion, for example, is more than enough to house every one of the homeless people in the country. We could effectively end homelessness with a lot of money to spare. $74 billion is enough to fund enough renewable energy to power almost every household in the country. It's enough to create 1 million jobs in clean energy, which is enough to transition pretty much every worker who currently works in coal, oil, and gas in the fossil fuel sectors. It could increase the number of public elementary school teachers by 50% by hiring 900,000 additional teachers, which is kind of a big deal right now as people are really concerned justifiably about how schools are going to reopen in the time of COVID. So smaller classroom sizes could be very helpful in keeping people safely social distanced. If this were given to coronavirus prevention, it would be enough to test every American 6 times over the next year. And that's at a time when we have all these shortages of coronavirus tests. So they're just all these different things. So we laid out 10 trade-offs, but there are so many more that you could think of. And the tool, we have a tool on our website called the Trade-Offs Calculator, where you can put in any amount of money or compare existing amounts of funding for federal programs, and it'll break it down, that amount of money down into different social priorities, how much that could have spent. So you can see how much that this portion of military spending could have bought in terms of green jobs, education, healthcare, child support, all sorts of things that are currently not funded enough.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the tool on the National Priorities Project website, because right now I've got up the cost of the war on terror since 2001, which is also another effective tool, I think, that listeners should know about and share with family, friends, neighbors, comrades, because it in fact, every time I look at it every few months, it's kind of shocking how just the total cost of wars since 2001, now we're up to $5 trillion, and the counter, because you have a lifetime or real-time counter that's quickly moving, you know, that amount is increasing by the second. And one can just click off on the trade-offs. What could these dollars buy? And so even just something like, I mean, what's an example of like a weapon system, or just, you know, some kind of concrete example of an expenditure that could be translated into something else, a more socially useful product?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we put out a study from the National Priorities Project last year, or a report rather, called the Moral Budget with the Poor People's Campaign, which called for $350 billion in cuts from the Pentagon, so almost by half. And we laid out all the things that could cut, starting with low-hanging fruit, like just ending the wars, for example, which would amount to something like $60 to $70 billion as of last year. And that would involve bringing the troops home and closing foreign bases. The U.S. has over 800 foreign military bases outside of U.S. borders. The next country that has the most has only about 20. So we could close 60% of all those bases, and that would be something like $90 billion. So that's even more than the cuts we're talking about this year, $74 billion. And in terms of particular weapon systems, so there are just all these weapon systems and ships and aircraft that cost billions of dollars. So, for example, Navy destroyers, I'm not sure what the total amount is, but we suggested in our report that we could cut 16 of them, and that would save $8 billion. We could cut aircraft in half and then cancel existing orders for new ones, and that would be $7 billion. We could retire certain systems like the F-22 jet that aren't considered useful anymore, and that would be $4 billion. The F-35 is a popular example of just a jet fighter that's extremely expensive and just has not lived up to the potential it was thought to have, and that's estimated as having cost $1.5 trillion over its lifetime, which is more than the entire GDP of Australia. So they're we're talking about enormous numbers over time. Like the F-35 is a plane with over 900 performance deficiencies. Among the problems is like a dangerous night vision defect in the pilot's helmet, which cost $400,000. So it's just something that is basically, it continues to have money funneled into it because the weapons contractors are making money from it. But there are plenty of people within the military who say that it's not necessary or that it's not actually helpful. But it just keeps getting more money because people in Congress are so heavily lobbied by the weapons industry.
And it does seem like any reasonable person just looking at those stats and the trade-offs would come to a much different conclusion. And I think there'd be broad consensus about diverting that flow to socially useful good. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Ashiq Sadiq, who's a research analyst for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we're talking about the U.S. military budget. Ashiq, even though military spending is at historically high levels, we see no media attention or critique. In fact, I'm just looking today at, the mainstream press is now focusing on, I'm quoting here, a darkening U.S. budget, blaming rising deficits on the relief payments to U.S. households, even though this week there's been this discussion of this huge budget for the Pentagon. And, it almost seems surreal that there's no critique of it. Doesn't it also seem like the higher the investment, the more and more the U.S. spends, it's got to justify its expenditures, and that we're more likely to move to escalation?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and it's absolutely incorrect and misleading to say that the deficits are because of the expenditures on social safety. And, just to use the deficit as a weapon against any possible social ends, like things that would actually help people and meet human needs, while the military budget keeps being increased every year, while tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations keep going up every year. There are so many answers to how we can pay for the things that actually help people, but those are just always drowned out by these, concern trolling remarks about needing to be fiscally responsible. Like that logic goes out the window every time the military budget is up for debate. But the reality is that with just, tax breaks for the wealthy, like all these loopholes that are baked into the tax code, those amount to, like if we had a fair tax code, it would bring in enough revenue that to surpass all of the discretionary budget spending that the federal government has. Like right now, the entire discretionary budget that the government allocates every year from Congress is something like $1.3 trillion, and the amount of tax breaks amounts to more than that. So that's just stuff that's baked into the tax code to give handouts to people who really don't need it, to corporations that do not need it. Meanwhile, the burden of taxes is on the average taxpayer, like workers and just normal people. So there's always money to pay for things, and the military budget is a really good place to start if we want to pay for nice things.
Right, and I really recommend people take a look at the Poor People's Campaign Moral Budget, because in addition to outlining those cuts to the military, the moral budget also outlines ways in which to retrieve fair taxes on the wealthy and corporations, Wall Street, and many more billions that could be raised for putting to addressing climate change, addressing inequalities, all kinds of useful services to people in this country. not to mention just stopping the harm that this country is doing around the world.
That's right.
So, Ashiq, just in the last minute that we have, where do we go from here? How can we organize to defund the military? I mean, your analysis of the vote this week seems to suggest that, you know, it's not as bleak as we might think. So at this moment when many people are reconsidering budgets, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement just really bringing attention to how municipalities need to reconsider how they devote their budgets by defunding the police and funding more socially useful programs, how can we get people to organize around this notion of defunding the military?
Yeah, I think it's really important to reframe this in terms of what's happening just across the country over the past few months, like with coronavirus, with the uprisings against police violence and structural racism. I think this is a really big change in how people have been talking about federal budgets or local budgets for many years. The Black Lives Matter movement, I think from the beginning, had this paradigm of defunding from state structures that cause harm and reinvesting in programs that actually help people who have been historically oppressed and, you know, ultimately help everybody achieve their potential as people. So I think this is something that is going to keep developing. The next budget is going to be deliberated next year, and there's actually a really big opening next year to just fundamentally transform federal priorities, because something called the Budget Control Act, which was put into place in 2011 in the middle of the last big economic recession that started in 2008, that imposed budget caps on military versus non-military spending and basically put into law that they have to roughly track each other. So that's going to expire next year in 2021. It lasted 10 years. So that's actually a big opportunity for progressives, for people of conscience, to organize to just really fundamentally transform how disproportionately federal funds go to the military versus anything that actually helps people. So I think, it's disappointing, obviously, that this sensible budget cut failed this year. But I think as people keep organizing and making stronger connections across movements, there is a really big opportunity next year and beyond to just, you know, do much more organizing leading up to that. Like, the organizing around this 10% cut came together pretty quickly over just a matter of weeks. So just thinking about how long it can change, it could take to change federal priorities. I think this vote sets a stronger baseline for people to just keep organizing around in ways that will hopefully bear fruit by next year. So I'm cautiously optimistic about this particular issue, just because it seems like more and more it's becoming unavoidable for more people who are, you know, seeing real pain, like in their own lives and in their own communities. And just if we can make stronger connections to how the federal budget is allocated in extremely immoral ways, I think there's a big opportunity to transform things. So it'll take a lot of work, but it starts with, you know, just finding organizations and networks in your own locality that are organizing around this, and just getting people to make stronger connections. Like, the reason that, you know, whatever your particular set of issues is, the reason why that's being ignored by people in government and underfunded has a lot to do with the over-militarization of federal budgets and local budgets.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Ashiq, for coming on the show today. We'll provide links to your work at the National Priorities Project on the Old Mole KABU website. And you can find the work of Ashiq Siddique, that's S-I-D-D-I-Q-U-E, widely on the web and Twitter. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Say it again, y'all.
What?
Look out.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Listen to me.
That was Edwin Starr telling us about war, which, as Ashiq Siddique and Laurie Mercier discussed before that, is good for the bottom line of military contractors. I'm Fran Michelle. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You'll be able to find this show, its segments, and much more from The Mole at our show page at kboo.fm. Thanks to all the contributors to today's show. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Mike Friedman, for their conversation about responses to COVID-19, and to Denise Morris for editing. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of The Vanishing Half, and to Patricia Kullberg for reading and recording it. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and Ashik Sadiq, and thanks to all the volunteers and staff who keep KBOO on the air, and to the listeners and members who make that possible. If you're not yet a member, or even if you are, you can contribute by going to the website at kboo.fm and clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner. We'll be back next Monday with more from the Old Mole Variety Hour.